Have you ever been surprised when you're in a particular situation expecting a certain reaction from either one person or several who are around you? Have you ever been surprised at the way someone acted or reacted? You expected something else. Maybe you announce that, pick something of your own thinking. I'll give you one or two here. You tell someone your wife is pregnant, and you're thrilled. But you already have five children, and they think two is too many, and you tell them that this is number six, and they wonder, what's wrong with you? You know, they say something like that, or other things I could think of. But in your mind, you're on your way to 12, and so you're excited. You'd be surprised how people see the number of children differently. I've counseled couples for marriage, saw one marriage that was on its way to occurrence, to happening, and the man thought maybe he would want two children, but probably one. And the woman sort of thought, well, maybe we could limit it to six, but more would be preferable. And they had never discussed it. And then along came Mr. Pack with this 8-foot-long monkey wrench, and he threw it into the works, and it blew up the marriage. But as I've often said, let's get those things out in the open before they get married. I remember one couple where the woman had cats and the man didn't like cats, but they never discussed them until the very end of the counseling. And he made a reference to, you know, well, my wife has these cats, but after we get married, of course, she'll be getting rid of them. And she looked at him in the counseling. This is quite a moment for me. And she said, oh no, I won't. And he said, well, of course you will. And that was the end. The cat stayed and he went. And you'd be amazed what needs to come out but sometimes doesn't. In a world where divorce is easy, I guess it isn't so big a problem anymore. I was reading an article this morning about a new website where you can pay X amount of money to get an online divorce. So I guess people don't have to worry about being thorough before they get married. It's called Divorce Online, or Online Divorce, I think is the name of the site. But in this world, who would expect different, I suppose. So people react in ways that you wouldn't expect. If you get a promotion on the job and you tell a friend who's also at the same company and they wanted the promotion, you may expect them to rejoice with you, and instead the reaction is jealousy. So you can expect people to act or react to events in a certain way. Sometimes you're right and other times you're wrong. You didn't read the situation correctly. You supposed you'd get a certain reaction, but something very different happened instead. Now, let's change to a little different venue and look at this in another way. If you have sinned against someone and you go to them, you could, in theory, get two different reactions. Now, maybe you don't go to them. Maybe they just find out about it. They could be very forgiving. They could be very angry. They could be very angry first and then very forgiving. So there are various different things that happen in a situation like that, and you never quite know when you're dealing with a free moral agent. When you're dealing with people in any given situation, you're dealing with free moral agents who can decide to react one way when you or I may have anticipated another. Now, if you did or said something in the direct presence of Jesus Christ, do you think you would always know how he would react? Would you expect him to react a certain way and then always be correct in your assessment, your supposition? Or, now let's change it a little differently. Let's still involve Christ again. If you both witnessed, you and Christ, both witnessed the exact same event, could be anything, could be an earthquake where a lot of people died. It could be a sin. You both could be standing beside the Twin Towers as they were struck by jets and collapsed, or anything else you can imagine. Would you react as he would? Now, if Christ, then, going a step further, if Christ now is watching the way you react to something that you witness or perhaps are involved in, as per other human beings, could be anything, hundreds of thousands of things that life throws at all of us, and he reviewed your conduct, are you sure that you know what his assessment of you would be? Are you sure you know exactly what value, assessment, criticism, praise he would assign you? Now, most in this world have a concept of Christ. There's more than one wrong concept of Christ. I'm going to actually give you a profile of 10 different kinds of false Christs. But we're entering the Passover season. We're going to be focusing on the true Christ. The world's not. They're not even going to be focusing on him at all in the Passover. They're going to focus on a host of different kinds of false Christs during a false holiday of this world called Easter. They don't know how Christ would react in any given situation. There are many Jesus Christs in the world, probably a lot more than the 10 I'm going to briefly profile as we then move on to profile the real Jesus Christ through a series of contrasts. You'll just have to wait to see what I have in mind, but before we're ready for that, we need to take a look at the false Christs. And as you go through it, ask yourself, is there any possible way that your assessment, your view, your profile, the way you and I, myself too, view Christ incorrectly because we've made assumptions or the many kinds of false Christs of this world may have, in one or more cases, rubbed off on us, or we've still never expunged it from our thinking? Now, the Bible plainly says, through Paul, to the Corinthians, that people can believe in a false Christ, another Christ. There's only one true Christ. Now, there's lots of other false ones. Here are 10. There is the common picture of the weak Christ. And by the way, some of these overlap, but I want to sort of give you the different profiles in an individual way. Of course, there are people who mix and match these false Christs so that he is or does anything they need him to be or do to suit their view of their own Christianity. So people will, as I like to put it, mix and match Christ, like clothing, so that he fits what they want him to be instead of what he is and, frankly, what they need him to be to help them through their lives. So there is the weak Christ. I refer to the Jeffrey Hunter of the 50s, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, nothing wrong with blonde hair and blue eyes, but this sort of sallow-faced, hangdog look. Now, here's the being who supposedly, people believe, we know it happened, but supposedly they believe he made the sun, moon, and stars and the entire universe, and he looks like he couldn't curl 5 pounds in each hand, let alone curl Alpha Centauri in his left hand and Betelgeuse in his right. Those are both stars. So there's the weak Christ, the wimpy, opposite of strength, nothing man, mountain, dean about him. To many people, that's the only Christ they know. Then there's the number two, the fiery Christ. This is the Christ who overturned the money changers, who would preach fire and brimstone if he was an evangelical preacher in any one of this world's churches. He would thunder a lot, speak with authority. That's their view of Christ. And a lot of people who have that view of Christ have it because that's what their preacher's like. And they assume their preacher represents God, and they see God, not just Christ, but God himself is constantly thundering at people. And then it's pretty easy to bring in various pictures of the Old Testament, even though some, of course, completely disconnect Christ from the Old Testament. There are others that sort of he gets merged in with this thundering God of the Old Testament. In fact, that is Christ. But in a greater overemphasis, an improper emphasis, people see him as fiery. Then there's the effeminate Christ. It's been said that the first pictures of Christ, and I think they go back many centuries before this, but the first well-known pictures of Christ were really Michelangelo painting pictures of his homosexual lover. That's who they are. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Whether those are the very first, I don't know. But that's the common picture. Very effeminate, back to, again, very weak, very soft, very swishy, as we would say. Nothing manly about him. Nothing carpenter-like about him. Nothing about him that could pick up a saw. I don't mean that Christ had to look like a wrestler. Abraham Lincoln was, this incredible rail splitter, powerful, could hold a double-bladed axe out with one hand, skinny guy, but could hold it out for, a couple minutes. Try it sometime. He wasn't heavy, very slender. And yet Abraham Lincoln, most people don't talk about this aspect of him, was an extremely powerful man. I've studied a lot about him. Extremely powerful man. And yet just practically reed thin. Then there's the dead Christ in a loincloth. Of course, Christ was crucified in the nude, so that picture's wrong right there. You're going to humiliate and bring and the Phoenicians and the Romans, who basically perfected crucifixion, were in the purpose of inflicting pain and suffering, and crucifixion was horrifically painful, much more. The easiest part was when you got nailed onto the stake. One of the ways you inflicted pain was you stripped them nude, and you stripped away all their dignity as they died over a period of 6 to 10 hours. Screaming so loud that usually their tongue had to be cut out so that people could sleep if they lived longer than they were supposed to in a given day. That's literally the truth. Someone would go up and cut the tongue out so people around wouldn't be bothered anymore by the screaming from the tetany as oxygen deprivation struck all the soft tissues of the body. And just like every cell in the body screams. So here's this picture of a dead Christ with a little blood here and a little blood on the side, little from the crown of thorns, a loincloth, and with his legs kind of crossed in a certain way, kind of one leg bent in a certain way, the way some Parisian effeminate fashion designer would have him stand, all right, only he's on the stake. With his head tipped off to the side, and a lot of people's concept of Christ swinging on their dashboard by their mirror or on a bracelet or a necklace. There is that vision of Christ, dead, helpless, because he's dead, can't do anything, can't strengthen anybody. Well, then there's another one that you typically see at Christmas time, and that's the baby Jesus. The vision many people have of Christ never moves past the false concept of this baby at Christmas time. You see them out on people's front yards with the quote-unquote wise men. They're kneeling down with Mary and Joseph standing over him in the manger, and there's this baby. Now, that suits a lot of people's purpose because, after all, if you have a Christ who has too much power and strength, then, of course, he has authority over our lives, and that's not going to suit people who need him to be weak and helpless, a baby, somebody that we would need to help. Now, babies, let's face it, Christ was a baby, but there's no photographs of Christ as a baby. That whole scene is baloney. We understand that. It's ridiculous. But yet it's a very convenient and perfectly suited depiction of Christ for all the people who don't want his power in their life but want to see him as someone almost who needs them rather than the other way around. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Christ needs people. Look at Protestant religion. They picture Christ as wanting you to come to him, if you'll just come to him. He's just heartbroken if you don't. They have no idea that Christ decides who he's going to call. Actually, the Father does the calling. And then Christ enters them and works with them. The Spirit of the Father draws them to Christ. People don't understand that. They ignore John 6:44 and 65, and they see this Jesus who just desperately needs people to come to him to sort of pick up his day, I guess. Number six. There are those who see Christ as a revolutionary. You'd be surprised how many people use the fact that Christ talked about another kingdom coming to justify revolution, overthrowing governments. Christ talked about how his kingdom is not of this world, and it's going to do away with the kingdoms of this world. And he's sort of pictured as a young Che, a young Castro, or like this new Venezuelan president who many are concerned is so sort of half socialist revolutionary, half capitalist democratic, you know, Chavez, as a lot of people concerned. And, you know, he one of his mentors, he's very favorable toward Castro. But some see Christ as a revolutionary. Others see him as a combination of three things. This is one profile. Combination philosopher, pragmatist, interesting theologian. Philosopher, pragmatist, interesting theologian. Said a lot of interesting socially oriented things. Had an approach to society. The Protestant evangelical social gospel attributed to the lips of Christ because he spoke to certain things that were happening in society, which really was speaking to sins that were causing things in society. People have sort of, you know, taken in the way they want, and they see Christ as this philosopher. Even the Muslims see him as a prophet, so you could even throw that one in. That's not on my list. He had some good ideas. He wasn't the greatest prophet. Muhammad was, but he was a prophet. They believed that he was. Not the Son of God. But Christ was a pragmatic person. He spoke in parables. And just look at how practical he was. Now, the reality is those parables that a lot of people think they understand, we know they don't. He spoke in parables so people wouldn't get the point. But people look at those parables and say, now, why did he do that? Since they assume they understand him and ignore that he said he did it so they wouldn't, they assign some other reason for the parables, and they say he was a practical man. He was pragmatic. He could look at farming situations and other issues where stewards and householders people who were working the land and with laborers and the parable of the penny and the wheat and tares and, you know, animals, the sheep and the goats, and he could draw practical things, and that's how they see Christ. Well, the next one kind of flows from that to a certain degree, and that is he was a visionary. There's the visionary Christ. He could look out beyond and see beyond the big picture. Well, certainly the true Christ could, but he wasn't a Gandhi. Gandhi is considered a visionary too. There are a lot of people who are considered visionaries. Nostradamus is considered a visionary and a prophet. Bill Gates is an entrepreneurial visionary. There are a lot of people who have visions. Adolf Hitler was a visionary. He dreamed of 1,000 years of Nazi rule in Europe. Like, nobody can say he didn't have big vision. He just had the wrong vision. But some see Christ as sort of this person who dreamed big, thought big, but they don't understand the reality of what Christ saw coming when the kingdom of God came to this earth. They don't understand that part of it. Then there's the hippie Christ. You should be surprised if you didn't live in the 60s, how many people believed that Christ was their role model for the free love, because Christ talked about love, and the beards and the long hair and the whole thing that was the hippie movement that has never fully died. It's still alive in certain places. That's the ninth one, if you're counting them all. And the last one is a different Christ than all of these, the hypostasic Christ. You say, what? The hypostasis? Well, that's the one that slew scores of thousands of people, merged with some of these others, back in the worldwide Church of God. Christ was this hypostasis. As I like to put it, he was sort of part of this three-in-one being. You know, there was the glorified psychic Christ and the infinite eternal Christ. So there were really two Christs. One was sort of this divine carcass that came down here and died. You've heard me talk about this. And the other one was sort of part of the Siamese triplets of the Trinity, where he couldn't really get loose because one-third of one being, three in one, you know, one-third of one being can't die. You can't have 33.3% of one being die and the other two-thirds of that same being stay alive. So they had to create the concept of two Christs. Every Trinitarian believes a version of the doctrine of Antichrist. There was the Christ that died because they have to believe that they have a Savior, but when you believe in the Trinity, you can't. There's no way to say one-third of one being can die. And so they have to believe that the more important Christ in the Godhead didn't die, which means we have no Savior. So there are so many false Christs. And by the way, there are 10 different versions of the Trinity. The Greek Orthodox version, which smote the worldwide Church of God to the fundament, and it's a wrong understanding because a Greek fellow pretty much came up with it from his past, is one of the most liberal versions of the Trinity. As I've often said, one of the reasons people didn't recognize it as one of the 10 versions of the Trinity is because it was one of the most liberal versions, one of the most philosophic, gobbledygook versions, and people were told that it's not really the Trinity, and since they didn't recognize anything they learned in the Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, or Lutheran church, they sort of thought it was the Trinity. They were wrong. In any event, Bruce Barton wrote a book we were all required to read back at Ambassador College entitled The Man Nobody Knows. Still not a bad book to read if you can get hold of it. The Man Nobody Knows. The Jesus Christ that nobody knows. They've come up with a lot of wrong versions of Christ, but he's the one that nobody knows. Now, Christ said that he is the same, Hebrews 13:8, yesterday, today, and forever. Christ has always been exactly who he is today. He always will be. He always has been. Christ is not a moving target. Now, why do I use that term? Well, remember, 1 Peter 2:21 says that we are to walk in his steps. Well, if Christ is constantly shifting and he's not the same, he isn't exactly who he said he is, and he's going to remain that way for the rest of time, Because he's the same God who said, I'm the eternal, I change not, Malachi 3:6. Then he's a moving target. You can't really figure out how to copy him. But you can sort of pick and choose, or as I put it, mix and match whatever Christ you need him to be so that your religion is essentially as easy as, or as hard as, or whatever you want it to be. But there's only one Jesus Christ. Now, last week in the announcements, I referenced, I think it was even in the sermon I made a reference to it, this ad from Illinois. I want to read a little bit more of it. It talks about the eight compelling reasons why Christ will return soon. It gives these eight reasons from prophecy. Then you come down to the escape plan. Of course, we know God has a place of safety planned. Here's what this individual, and I did find out, one wealthy individual is placing these phenomenally expensive ads, apparently around the country. There's one person. No group is behind it. One concerned person. And in the ad, it talks about the escape plan. Ready? Christ's death and resurrection. What Christ is this, as we read through, have opened the way to heaven and life with the Father forever for all who put their trust in him. Now, you've read at this point the eight signs that he's coming soon. Trust in him and his great sacrifice on our behalf. Christ will soon come and rescue his people from the approaching great tribulation. Well, that is true. And then he cites 1 Thessalonians 4:13-18. He will later rule and bring peace on earth. Well, I don't think we disagree with that. After he judges the world and every person. Well, that's wrong. Then they cite Matthew 25, the parable of the sheep and goats, and they don't understand that, or this person doesn't. God's judgment is indeed coming on a world in rebellion. Would you disagree with that? His attributes of perfect holiness and justice demand judgment for sin, of which we are all guilty. Well, I pretty much agree with that. Then they cite Romans 3:23, all have sinned. Now listen to this. The result of sin is death, comma, or separation from God. Then they cite Romans 6:23 that says the wages of sin is death, and it does not go on with a comma and add or separation from God. But what they mean is they're trying to fit in the hell scenario. I find it marvelous that people will quote a verse and then say, but it could also mean this, but it could mean what it says. That's an option. Wages are something we earn or deserve. Would you disagree with that? How many times did Mr. Armstrong say wages is something you earn? But God is love. His love is in conflict with judgment? Answer, God's wisdom reconciled the dilemma. The Son of God would take all our judgment upon himself, but God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. To escape God's judgment, we each must receive his free gift and so forth. How to receive him now? In any gift exchange, there has to be giver and receiver. God has already given us the gift, his Son. Now we must receive him. And then cites John 1:12, must receive him to have the right to become children of God. Then cites Ephesians 2:8 and 9, skips verse 10, important verse 10, about how we're saved by grace through faith, but then they forget the part about we're God's workmanship. We receive him by personal invitation, and then they cite this. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him. That is Christ talking to Laodicea. That's Christ talking to converted people who he's trying to wake up. And then he asks, do you hear his voice? Complete misunderstanding. Then they suggest, here's a prayer that you go pray. Lord Jesus, would you do this and that for me? And then it ends. They have a vision of Christ mixed with certain truths. And that ad, a quarter of a page in a lot of newspapers across the country, paid for by one individual, is directly from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So then, who is the real Christ? We're going to use some stop action in his life, if you will. We're going to turn the camera on and off and on and off, and we're going to contrast Christ, and we'll start by turning to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew chapter 23. read through much of the chapter. Now, I started the sermon by asking, would you react, would I have reacted the way Christ did in various situations? Would you have known how he would react? Do you know how he would react if he saw you? In other words, do you understand what Christ would do in a given situation? If you do, you're going to have a lot easier time and do a lot better, and so will I, of copying him, of following him. If we don't really know who he is or what he would do or how he saw things, how in the world are we going to copy him? Remember, a Christian is one who looks like Christ. I don't mean physically, but we're being made in his image spiritually, just as much as in his image and likeness, his and the Father's, as stated in Genesis 1. All right, now, Matthew 23. Then spoke Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do, but do not you after their works, for they say and do not. For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders. Ooh, he's pretty tough on them. But they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. We say today, you want to know where the term? You wouldn't lift a finger to help me. That's exactly where it comes from. I did all this myself and you didn't lift a finger. They're quoting Christ's indictment of people who put tremendous burdens on others and didn't lift a finger to help them. But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. They do all these physical accoutrements hanging on their clothing with scriptures and other symbols, and love the uppermost rooms at feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the markets, and be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi, Teacher, Teacher. Oh, they're talking about me. Now be not you called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ. So what are Jewish people still called to this day? Rabbi. They, of course, ignore this instruction. And all are your brethren. And call no man your father upon the earth. So what do Christians do? They call a man their father on the earth. And they call lots of priests their father. It's 45,000 priests in this country. And they're all called father. For one is your Father, which is in heaven. Neither be you called masters, for one is your Master, even Christ. He that is greatest among you, let him be your servant. Verse 13. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, and you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are entering to go in. Wow, you call somebody, are you a hypocrite? How would you feel if somebody called you a hypocrite? Now, we're looking at a period here in Christ's ministry near the end of his life when he's very strong, very tough, and frankly very harsh on the surface. Would you say, this is Christ? We're seeing Christ. This is Christ. Well, certainly we are seeing him. There is this side of him. Verse 14, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. 15, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. I mean, if somebody's standing in your face, say, you hypocrite, you did this. Then they said again, you hypocrite, you did that. They don't just cite three things, they say it a third time. You hypocrite, you did this again. They say it a third time. Then they call you blind, verse 16. Which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing, but whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he's a debtor to the oath. You fools and blind. Now Christ tells us, call no man fool. Somebody calls you a fool, blind, and a hypocrite three times, that isn't somebody you're going to spend the afternoon with. Well, thank you very much. Let's go golfing. I don't think you'd do that. That's incredibly strong. And verse 19, there it is again, you fools and blind. Verse 23, you hypocrites. Verse 24, you blind guides, 25, you hypocrites. 26, you blind Pharisee. 27, hypocrites. 29, hypocrites. You build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchers of the righteous, put flowers all over them, but you're the very people who killed them. Absolute hypocrisy. It's the very attitude that they had that killed some of the Old Testament prophets. Christ could see that. Wherefore, be witnesses unto yourselves that you are the children of them which killed the prophets. I did much as call them killers. Fill you up then the measure of your fathers. You serpents. Now, anybody says to you, you snake, you snake. How would you feel about that? How will you escape the damnation of hell or Gehenna, hellfire? I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some you kill, you crucify, you scourge, you persecute them from city to city, you chase them, and then you put flowers on their graves? You paint their sepulcher? That upon you, 4,000 years later, may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. All of those. Now that's serious. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. And yet, in verse 37, Christ virtually, if I can use this analogy, almost appears to whiplash to a completely different view. Instantly, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kill the prophets and stone them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Christ says, oh, I'd have just loved to reach around you and wrap you up and bundle you up. You know, we talk about somebody who has a lot of children and takes care of them. Certain school teachers are this way. She's just a mother hen. Well, that's exactly, I'd just have mother hen you. I'd have mothered you. But you wouldn't do it. Now, that's a very different Christ, a very different side of the same Christ who said all the things in the first 36 verses. Now I ask you, would you have reacted like Jesus did? Would you have reacted like Jesus did? When he was speaking to an individual group who had done horrific things to other human beings, he indicted them over and over again. His anger, his consternation, and a certain part of his frustration later came out. When he looked over the whole city and the whole picture of mankind, now considering all those who were having the burdens bound on them, who were having to move all their fingers while some wouldn't lift a finger, now all of a sudden a very different aspect of Christ came out instantly. Would you have known which way to be to each when you're talking to the group, one way, to the whole city, another? Would you have reacted like Jesus did? Matthew 4. And verse 1. Matthew 4 and verse 1. But then Jesus was led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. When he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was afterward and hungered, no doubt. And when the tempter came to him and said, if you be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Then the devil took him up into the holy city and set him on a pinnacle of the temple. Cast yourself down. Verse 7, you shall not tempt the Lord your God, Christ answered. And the devil took him to an exceeding high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And I'll give you this if you fall down and worship me. Verse 10, get you hence, Satan. Get you hence. We would say, get out. That's the King James for get out. For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. I guess, in theory, the third most powerful being in the universe, perhaps tied for third with Michael and Gabriel as cherubs. Of course, they are tapped into the power of God, so maybe you could say he's the fifth most powerful. I don't know exactly how you would measure that. But the moment Christ said, get, he left. That must have been tremendous authority to cause the devil to leave on the spot. Get out. Pretty tough. Well, of course, he was talking to the devil, but pretty tough. No wimp here. No sallow-faced, hangdog, stoop-shouldered, never worked a day in his life Christ here. John 11. Christ of Matthew 4, having not eaten for 40 days, was a tremendously strong, tough, and when he had to be, very harsh on the devil. John 11, verse 1, now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary, and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore, his sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Well, Christ was capable of loving other human beings, even if they didn't have God's Spirit. I witnessed some today who profess to be Philadelphian in this group or that, and who act as though they absolutely hate people who do have God's Spirit. That's hard for me to understand, except they're just horribly deceived. Here's someone who didn't have God's Spirit, that these two sisters knew Christ loved. Christ didn't cut and say, wait a minute, where'd you get that idea? Of course he did. He loved Lazarus. This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When he heard, therefore, that he was sick, he hurried over to Lazarus and healed him. No, that's not what it says. He waited 2 days still in the same place where he was. That didn't look loving. It confused people who looked at him. He said he loved them. They said, you love us. His reaction is, don't worry about it, and didn't do anything for 48 hours. Then after that said he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. His disciples said to him, Master, the Jews have late sought to stone you, and go you there also. They didn't understand his thinking. They were right with him. They didn't get it. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he sees the light of the day. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbles, because there's no light in him. These things said he, and after that said unto them, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll do well. He's probably just tired. What do you mean he sleeps? They didn't get it again. He's just taking a nap. Let's not wake him up. He may need his beauty sleep. Verse 13, howbeit Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest and sleep, a nap. Even though they'd heard the sisters say, you know, he was dead. Then Jesus said unto them, oh, look, let me speak plainly. Lazarus is dead. And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there to the intent you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us go also, that we may die with him. There was a mass suicide pact. When I look at Thomas, I recognize how here is a fine and decent human being, completely misled. Thomas is going to rule one of the 12 tribes of Israel, and yet he was willing because he was misled. There's just a message here. He was willing because he was misled to enter into a suicide pact. And he wasn't even really being asked to. Here's a man who undoubtedly is a great servant of God. Once he was converted, here he wasn't, who says, yeah, let's enter into a suicide pact together. You don't think it's easy for people to make those kinds of decisions? To just do irrational things that defy reality and do it like that? Sure they do. That's why this is recorded for us. I wonder sometimes when I look at some of God's people, I hear about where they're holding up here, they're going down to Central America, or they're going to Utah, or they're building a compound. I've heard of three or four different situations. If I were the devil, by the way, I'll just tell you, and that's not what the sermon's about, if I were the devil before the age is over, I'd have some people connected to the worldwide Church of God once upon a time, but more specifically now connected to Herbert W. Armstrong's beliefs, do something really horrible. I remember in the 70s when a member in good standing, I believe he was at the time, in Australia, tried to blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque and speed prophecy up. Some of you who were around, any of you around at that time, you remember that? None of you? Okay, a few of you. Let me tell you, that was shocking. All over the world, somebody tried to be, was there, this Christian from somewhere trying to blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque and was arrested. And we found, ooh, he's a member of the Worldwide Church of God. There are people who have taken their lives, done terrible things. They just get sidetracked and they lose it. Then when Jesus came, he found that he'd lain in the grave 4 days already. Well, you begin to corrupt and stink and so forth. Many of the Jews came to Mary and Martha, Martha Mary, to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary sat still in the house. Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. Well, you'd had the power to heal him, but since he died, that's a bigger miracle than you're capable of. But I know that even now, whatsoever you will ask of God, God will give it you. All right, she sort of hoped. She's back and forth. Jesus said unto her, your brother shall rise again. Now, to show how back and forth she is, she didn't say, oh, he is going to heal him. Martha said unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. These are human beings who don't have God's Spirit. Faith wavers. It's like a wave. It comes in and comes out and comes in and comes out. If there's dark clouds on the horizon, human faith shrinks. If it's a sunny day and things are going well, human faith soars. That's why it's totally different and disconnected from the faith of God. Yet the Bible does talk about human faith. Christ healed people who didn't have God's Spirit, who didn't have real faith as a fruit of the Spirit, and yet he said your faith has made you whole. And according to your faith be it unto you. By the way, some have asked when I will cover the subject of healing. I might just say this so everybody in the church hears it at the same time, others in 2 weeks, and I sort of alluded to it in the letter yesterday. I will cover certain subjects when I'm writing about them. It's more natural, more easy for me. I can overlap and do a better job on both. I'll tell you when I'm going to cover healing, when I get to the booklet on healing. I know we need a booklet on the Sabbath. We need a sermon on how to keep the Sabbath, and I've got 2 sermons already prepared, proving you keep it, and then another one, how to keep it. I'll tell you when we're going to hear those, when I get to the Sabbath booklet. The same with the holy days. We need sermons on marriage and child rearing. I can tell you right now, those are going to be given when we get to booklets on marriage and child rearing. And so that's just a natural way that I'll do it. I've sometimes done that already, but I know that those sermons are necessary, and there are probably some others I'm not thinking of off the top of my head here. Well, Jesus said, I am the resurrection, the life, and he that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Believe you this? They said, yes. She arose, came to him, verse 29. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, skipping down, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then which were with her in the house and comforted her when they saw Mary, that she rose hastily and went out and followed her, saying, she goes to the grave to weep there. 4 days later, then when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. That was a very different Christ. And said, where have you laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see. Shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. Now, what would that have been like to see Jesus Christ cry? To see Jesus Christ cry. Does that make him weak? We live in an age when people want to be like John Wayne. They want to be like Charles Bronson, Clint Eastwood. Well, they'd never cry. They're tough guys, you know. They're James Cagney, although he cried in some parts. I've long believed that some of the Hollywood types since the 30s, I mean, Alan Ladd, Gary Cooper, you go back, you find the strongest, most popular actor, Steve McQueen, were all cool guys. They were cool. They didn't show emotion. Emotion was wimpy. They were all Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke, the old movie, just cool, handled everything. Well, Christ apparently, by that definition, was very weak. Yet he had tremendous power because he went on and did what he did in this account. Then said the Jews, behold how he loved him. As, well, he wasn't crying. They misunderstood why he was crying. So they could even see his crying, appreciate it, and misunderstood. And some of them said, could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? Then therefore, again, groaning in himself. I don't think you heard him groaning out loud. But John records groaning in himself. You ever groaned in yourself? Just, oh, you just feel deeply inside. Not an audible groan. Came to the grave. It was a cave, the stone laid upon it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, said to him, Lord, by now he stinks. They don't get it. They don't get it. For he's been dead 4 days. Jesus said, said I not unto you that if you would believe, you should see the glory of God? And they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Lord, I thank you that you have heard me. Verse 43. And when he thus had spoken, verse 42, I'm skipping, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And out comes this person, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face bound with a napkin. And people walked over and pulled it off of him. So there'd be no doubt Christ didn't heal him and throw that off of him. And you know what? He may have been naked at that point. Who knows? Loose him. Let him go. Incredible scene. Incredible scene. So which is the real Christ? The one who cried or who shouted at Satan, get out of here? Is it the mother hen or the one who in certain circumstances will call people serpents and hypocrites? Which is the real Jesus Christ? Matthew 16 and verse 21. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go into Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and be killed and raised the third day. Then Peter took him, began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from you, Lord, this shall not be unto you. But he turned and said to Peter, now this is tough. Get you behind me, Satan. The one who would lead the New Testament church, get you behind me, Satan. It doesn't say he said it to Satan. Of course he was talking to Satan, but literally this one who would lead the New Testament church was guided by Satan with that statement. And of course there's no doubt why. If Christ did not die, there would be no Savior of the world to help administer the government of God. What looks like a really brave, kind of bold statement of loyalty and support was absolutely treasonous against the plan of God and came from the being who would like to look supportive, but it really was the devil himself who does not want a Savior for mankind. You're an offense unto me. For you savor not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. He literally called Peter the devil, but sort of was speaking to the devil in him. But I mean, if somebody walked up to you and looked you right in the face and started speaking to you as though you were the devil, not talking about like you're influenced by the devil, you know, that is a profoundly, on the surface, harsh statement, thing to sort of contemplate enduring. What would you say to somebody who's trying to be supportive of you? Would you come off that strong in the face of somebody who's trying to save your life? Would you say, look, you're misguided, and thank you, and I appreciate that, but you misunderstand. Let me explain. Now let's absolutely flip the coin over, and let's go to Matthew 11. On the surface, it looked like Christ was awfully harsh and unfair to one who certainly we know history records was a great servant in God's work, and it was trying to support him. But Matthew 11 and verse 1, and it came to pass when Jesus had made an end of commanding his 12 disciples, he departed thence to teach and to preach in the cities. Now when John the Baptist, had heard in the prison the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said unto him, are you he that should come, or do we look for another? Now before we go on, please, brethren, stop. That is an astonishing, an absolutely incredible statement from one who is Christ's own cousin, who understood his conversion, who from birth was prepared to introduce him, who was a type of Elijah, the one between the original Elijah and Mr. Armstrong, one of the greatest servants of God of all time, and up to that point certainly was. There was none greater born among women than John the Baptist. And he got confused at the end of his life about whether Christ was Christ. And he was even a blood cousin. Now just, do you understand what we're seeing here? Are you Christ, or are we looking for the wrong person? Now, why do you think John might have gotten confused? Was it because he was a wimp? Well, study his life. That's ridiculous. He was, you know, feeling bad in prison? Of course not. Christ picked 12 disciples, and he wasn't one of them. Jesus answered and said to him, now here's Christ's answer to an incredible attitude on the part of one of the greatest human beings who had ever lived. Go and show John again those things which you both do see and hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk, and lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me. There is no doubt Christ knew John had an attitude where he was offended. He was upset by something that had happened. Yes, even wonderful servants of God can be terribly offended to the point of being confused about Christ. Why? Because John sort of wanted to be one of the 12. He didn't stop and say, look at what the 12 are doing. They're healing, preaching, casting out demons. Christ did not rebuke him. Peter tried to support Christ and got rebuked. Here's one who showed phenomenal lack of faith and indecision, probably born of jealousy, and Christ gave him a soft answer back. You would have expected him to get rebuked and Peter to get a little benefit of the doubt cut his way, wouldn't you? You see why I asked the question, would you react the way Christ would? Are you led by God's Spirit in the same way? You would think Christ would say, what, my cousin? We've played together for 30-some years? You know I was born of a virgin? You know the whole reason I'm here on earth is to save mankind, and at the last minute you have an attitude like that? What is wrong with you? No, he didn't have that attitude. He said, blessed is he who is not offended in me. Get over your offense. Both, in a way, were fighting the plan of God. Peter was blocking what Christ would do as Savior. John doubted he was the Savior. Mark 11. Let's go from Matthew 11 to Mark 11. Mark 11 and verse 15. And then he came to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. All right, he didn't just get mad. Picture somebody walking into a church, and they start knocking tables over. As I've often said, I'm sure today there would be people who say, Christ needs anger management classes. There'll be some, when they see God is angry for a whole year, in the year of his wrath, will say the same thing. At the end of the year, they might speak a little differently. And he would not allow that any man should carry any vessel through the temple. Now, how do you suppose he did that? Do you think he did it with his word? He's a very powerful man, a carpenter, remember. Do you think maybe he got a little physical? Stop, you're not going past. Well, yes, I am. Boom, they got a little bumping going on. How do you think he did that? He would not allow that any man should carry any vessel through the temple. What do you think happened? It doesn't say anything other than that. Did he stare them down? Well, I suppose it's possible. I don't know. But I suspect carnal minds wouldn't have stopped at that point. Maybe people were scared because they saw him knocking a lot of tables over. And he taught, saying unto them, it is not written, or is it not written, my house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. And the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him. Now, you call people a bunch of thieves when they are doing, on the one hand, perhaps honest business. I'm not so sure they were. They may have been doing a lot of underhanded stuff, but they were certainly doing in a wrong place. They were stealing from the purpose of the temple, and perhaps, now let's be honest, there's a real possibility they were doing some real stealing. They were certainly stealing the tithes of God in other ways, perhaps. Tremendous toughness, very harsh, very strong. For they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his doctrine. I don't think Christ went around and was violently hurting people, but he was doing some things we call violent. Do you think if he knocked over the table, some of them broke, and there was damage, stuff flew all over? I picture a scene of incredible chaos. Overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. Tables, chairs went flying. Picture someone walking into one of our potlucks where we've got tables and chairs. You wonder, did all the people get out of the chairs before they got knocked over? Did they fly with the chairs? I'm just reading from the scriptures. This is the Jesus Christ of the Bible. Would you have thought he was overreacting? Has Christ made a proper assessment here? I remember one of the things that I heard during the apostasy was some said, oh, well, Christ was not angry in this case, and they went on to explain something else. Can't remember what they said, but it sure struck me. They said, oh, he wasn't angry. I think something along the lines, he was reaching out or something. Anyway, Matthew 20, I don't remember exactly. Matthew 21, but I do remember that statement. Matthew 21 and verse 14. And the blind and lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. He healed them. Can you see him in that setting? Crippled people walking in. Blind people, just one verse. We're not going to read a long account here, just one verse. Now, of course, the next verse, the chief priests saw the wonderful things that he did. and the children crying in the temple, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, and they were sore displeased, saw wonderful things and were angry. But yet it says, he healed the blind and the lame. Very soft. The doctrine of healing, of course, has been rejected. We have some in the Restored Church of God who would argue with that. I've been healed dramatically, said this before. Some of you have been healed dramatically, more than one occasion. I mean instantly and dramatically. We've seen healings. I've seen it happen. God does heal. Again, it is a subject we need to cover. There's a lot of questions regarding healing that I know are floating around because of the apostasy, and they all need to be addressed. Matthew 21:19, verse 19, when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it, found nothing thereon, the leaves only. Now you're standing watching him. Here's his innocent tree. Hadn't done anything to anybody. Hadn't robbed any banks. And said unto it, let no fruit grow on you henceforward forever. And presently, on the spot, the fig tree withered away. Killed the tree. Now that looks like a senseless act. I'm sure a lot of tree huggers today would be very unhappy with that. They would have been happy if he'd hugged the tree, but instead he withered the tree. And you go back and forth. Christ would take a withered hand in other places and restore it. When it came to tree, he took restored trees and withered them. Would you have understood and reacted in the way that Christ did? Matthew 25. Verse 14, for the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. To every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made them other 5 talents. And likewise, he that had received 2, he also gained other 2, but he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants comes and reckons with them. And so he that received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered unto me 5 talents. I've gained besides 5 more. The Lord said, well done, you good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many. And enter you into the joy of the Lord. 2 talents, same thing. Well done. Verse 23, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. You enter into the joy of the Lord and you're ruler over many. Verse 24, then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew you, that you were a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid your talent in the earth. Lo, there you have, that is yours. I've given it back. His Lord answered and said unto him, ready, here it is. Are we going to see mercy? Are we going to see judgment? Which is it? We've gone back and forth in this sermon. You wicked and slothful servant, you knew. In other words, Christ understood on the basis of being able to say that, he had to know the man understood the rules of engagement for Christians. They knew the terms, the rules. You knew that I reap where I sowed not and gather where I have not strawed. You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I would have received my own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him and give it unto him which has 10 talents. And cast the unprofitable servant, verse 30, into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Would you have reacted like Christ? What would you have done? Why didn't he show a little mercy? The guy didn't destroy the talent. He buried it in a napkin. John 8. Gets a little more confusing when you look at this. John 8. verse 1. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman taken in adultery, and when they had set her in his midst, they said to him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. I'm sure they were very pleased with themselves. They really had a case. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what say you? You're going to try to put him in conflict, in opposition to Moses. It's a setup. This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. That's the goal here, in that way. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground as though he heard them not. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said to them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. It doesn't say what he wrote, but he probably, this is the most logical thought, is he wrote down her sins, or their sins. He knew them. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, that's not in the Bible, that was added, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest. Just filing by, and Jesus was left alone, the woman standing in the midst. In the midst of the disciples, they're still there. When Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are those your accusers? Has no man condemned you? She said, No man, Lord. And Jesus said unto her, Neither do I condemn you. Well, that's not exactly the way he talked to the servant who buried the napkin. Go and sin no more. Why did she get mercy? Why did the other person not? What was the difference? You might look over in Luke 19. Luke 19. When it comes to those in the parable of the pounds that Christ said would not be given rulership over cities, verse 27, here's really blunt. But those my enemies, which would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me. Well, why didn't the woman? Why didn't they say, kill the woman? You kill these people. Of course, there are other circumstances. We understand that. One had made a choice for the way of life they were going to live. They wouldn't let Christ reign over them. They would not develop their talents. They did not seek God, and it was a lifelong decision. God said, you're wicked. You're slothful. You knew it. Slay them. Here's a woman caught in an individual act of adultery. Pretty bad. Takes two to do that, so somebody else was involved. At least one other person got hurt for it to be adultery. One of them had to be married, maybe both, so two. Probably there were children. A lot of people got hurt. And yet he said, I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more. Translated, I forgive you. Just learn from it. Change. They got mercy. Would you have reacted like Christ in these situations, brethren? I'll tell you one thing you begin to notice. There are several things that if we had time, we could talk about them. We begin to notice the examples of where Christ was really strong with people run out. You'll find more examples if we decided to extend the sermon to 3 or 4 hours, or your own studies, you can do this, where Christ was compassionate. He understood. A lot of false Christians today would have let the wicked servant off the hook. And there are those who would have stoned the woman who was taken in adultery. The false love of Christianity and the sin of false accusation also part and parcel with so much of quote-unquote, you know, Christianity, pseudo professing Christianity, would have flipped those circumstances. They'd stone where there should be mercy, and they'd forgive where the person had used up any opportunity for forgiveness. You might think about that. I might just add, among the splinters, some are following various aspects of false Christs. Christ is perceived, just like any person sitting in front of a fire and brimstone preacher for a lifetime, to grow up in one of those type of churches. You perceive Christ and God that way. People in the splinters begin to see Christ the way the church administers. If everything is love, 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 then they sort of see Christ as having no standards. If the administration of a splinter group is administered like some kind of a brutal military dictatorship, they will see Christ as harsh and unforgiving. I'm not saying they're following false Christs, but all of us can slip into wrong concepts because we don't actually study what the real Christ is like. Now let's go on. We're not going to talk about any other examples of where Christ was strong or tough, but let's look at a few others. And let's reflect on it as we draw closer to the Passover. Matthew 18. Matthew 18 and verse 1. Look at the tender-hearted nature of Christ here. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Jesus called a little child unto him, and set him in the midst of them, and said, "Truly I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whosoever shall receive one such little child in my name receives me." It's very important how you receive these little children, how we deal with little children that Christ is calling. We and the staff and in the restored church of God, how I personally do, how all of us do, is extremely important to Christ. And we ought all remember verse 6, but whoso shall offend one of these little ones, which believes in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. In one verse, you have a huge contrast about Christ. He is so tender and careful, and he has these little children there. And in another sense, he's saying, "Oh boy, if you offend one of them, you might as well just strap on a millstone." Mark 10. Mark chapter 10, one final verse. And verse 46, Mark 10 and verse 46. And they came to Jericho, and as he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. What a pitiful scene. A lot of places in this world. I've walked by thousands of people in the years I was in New York begging. And it's a pitiful thing. And when he heard that, you go to India and a lot of other places, it's very common, heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, you son of David, have mercy on me." And many charged him that he should hold his peace, be quiet. But he cried the more a great deal, "You son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called, and they called the blind man, saying unto him, "Be of good comfort, rise, he calls you." And he, casting away his garment, rose and came to Jesus. And Jesus answered and said unto him, "What will you that I do unto you?" The blind man said unto him, "Lord, that I might receive my sight." And Jesus said unto him, "Go your way. Your faith has made you whole." We touched on that a while ago. And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus in the way. Perhaps went on to be converted. Who knows? At least in that way he did for a while. Maybe he went on to follow. Maybe we'll see Bartimaeus in the resurrection. Christ was concerned about his mother hanging on the stake, and he gave instructions to take care of her. When the high priest's servant's ear was chopped off, when Malchus' ear was chopped off, that was his name, Christ, about to die, put the ear of somebody who was there to assist in his death back on his head. He let crippled people through the roof, and a woman was healed who simply grabbed him in a crowd. On one occasion, he fed 5,000. Another occasion, I believe it was 4,000 or 3,000. And he called Judas friend. Yet Christ could be extremely strong. He could come on tremendously strong when he was dealing with, and here is the key, a really evil motive in a human being. He never, ever jumped down people's throat, so to speak, as we would say. Maybe that's a wrong term to use. He never hit very hard in marginal cases of simple sins or mistakes. He tolerated, he understood, he forgave. When he was dealing with true murderous evil, he was incredibly strong and dealt with it most directly. He dealt with Satan, the Pharisees, and other leaders who were wounding and hurting other people. He dealt with them in a very strong and stinging way. Do you now have a better understanding of how to conduct yourself just as Christ would have and did? Do you now better understand 1 Peter 2:21? We are to follow his steps as we enter the Passover season, and we reflect on how the real Jesus Christ died for us and not some other man-made counterfeit. Do you understand 1 Peter 2:21 better because a Christian is one who does what Jesus Christ did, who resists and reacts in situations as Jesus Christ resisted and reacted? A Christian is one who is what Jesus Christ was. It is this Jesus Christ, the forgiving Christ, in this profile, who died for us, that we reflect on in 24 days.